Peace.
At the Races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back at the races, and thanks to Matt for that complete coverage. And let's keep our fingers crossed. And I saw a note on Twitter and asking or noting that it's unusual or noteworthy that. You know, the jocks that have been positive that they haven't been sick. Well, just remember, Javier Castellano. Javier was sick. I mean, Javier was full-fledged sick, and so these are athletes. I mean, hell, I got it and didn't have and Tina and I both went through it, and it's not pleasant. Didn't feel great for 3 weeks. I mean, but I'm certainly not in the same shape that a jock is in. But if the jocks are warding it off, and it's not finding a receptive, because obviously this is a really insidious thing. I mean, that is finding. In fact, I was reading an extensive piece, about the autopsies, because they're finally getting, when things were, really acute in April, particularly in May, they really weren't having, the opportunity to, get the findings that they, a lot of clues to these kinds of epidemics and pandemics come from the autopsies, and they're starting to get that now. And when you see, medical officials that have been studying this stuff their whole careers and lives, exclaiming essentially their shock at things that they're finding. I mean, this thing just. Cancer does the same thing. It sort of seeks out a weak point of entry, and that's that gets to the underlying conditions. But I mean, the jocks are, these are people that are healthy as can be, and are in top physical condition. They're not going to have hypertension. They're obviously not overweight. They're not diabetic. Some of them are obviously they're on a weight control in a lot of cases, management, they don't seem. In fact, I hear Dick Powell joining us. Dick, good morning.
Steve, happy Bastille Day.
Oh, that's right, the 14th. Look at this. July, good for you, July 14th.
I love it. It's my wife's birthday, so I tend to remember it.
That's pretty funny. That's the association. I love it.
Yeah.
Well, Dick, we've obviously, it's funny because here we are at the end of the Hong Kong Jockey Club season, and, it was more difficult for them. It was more difficult for them at the beginning of the season, and they had, of course, the political unrest, and then came the illness and the alarms that went off for no attendance and things like that. They've worked their way through that, but just off that conversation I had with Matt Hegarty, and I think we've gotten so used to the way we're operating that guys got a little cavalier about going from track to track to follow their mounts. I think that's over for a little bit.
Yeah, it certainly sounds like it. Hong Kong has overcome more challenges this year than anyone can ever imagine. And yet, Sunday at Sha Tin, they did 1.97 billion Hong Kong dollars, which is 270 United States million dollars. I mean, that's phenomenal. And to their credit, they have the infrastructure that has been there all along. So when you couldn't go to the track and you couldn't do all the normal things, they still had a way of taking bets and keeping customers happy and things like that. So they've kind of gone up and down as far as restrictions. Or some days you see some people in the paddock. I think tomorrow it's probably going to be a little tighter than it had been. But they're fluid. They're responsive. They work with the government very closely. And yet their business has been so good, they're raising purses next year. So, I mean, that's a testament to being well-prepared. Even before the unrest happened, which is way, that was bad. I mean, they were closing down the track because they're afraid people are going to go to the track and not be able to get home if the transportation system was attacked or anything. So for them to have the season they had and finish on this incredible uptick is just remarkable, and got to give Hong Kong Jockey Club all the credit.
Well, certainly, sir, I would imagine that the international, as they were, pretty much back running and they obviously didn't get interrupted, but in terms of the actual racing for any length of time, but as we were, trimmed back to almost, next to nothing. I mean, to, five thoroughbred and two quarter horse tracks, internationally, between Europe and the UK, there was nothing. And I imagine that some of the shortfall, on track was picked up by, desperate, hungry, players from around the world.
Yes. But at the same time, Sunday, last weekend, yeah, all the tracks were racing.
That's right.
And they had this enormous day. And it's interesting because when there's not much else out there, if you're the one-eyed king, that's okay. But at the same time, you want a vibrant industry where people are interested in participating, not just in your track, but in other tracks. So it's kind of a downside. Like, everyone says, how come you don't race on Monday? No one's open. Well, no one's betting on Monday, reality. So that's always been an issue in the simulcast world. Do you want to race when everyone else is racing because all the customers are there? Do you want to have that niche when there's less competition, but then you might have less customers? So Hong Kong's just done it for 87 meets coming up tomorrow, the 87th meet, and they've just done fabulous. And their jocks don't travel, Steve. They were locked down. Many of their families went home. Zach Purton's family went back to Australia. He was not allowed to leave. None of them have been allowed to leave. So there hasn't been that kind of movement that we've seen over here, and it's a limited amount of people. I mean, there's right now there's. If they had a bigger starting gate, they might be short of jockeys because they only have 15, 16 active riders. So they obviously all get business. But there's been no travel. And then, in April, the international races didn't get many international horses. So you don't see the jock movement that we see here in other countries. Like last weekend, France has now opened up to non-French horses. We saw Godolphin come in and just have a phenomenal day on Sunday with Tubo and stuff like that. Well, a month before, that wouldn't have happened. That they had closed the border to shipping horses, not just, jocks and everybody else. So that's opened up more worldwide. But Hong Kong and their ecosystem is kind of built in to protect.
Let's take a peek. Let's kind of bring it full circle and kind of get everybody ready to say goodbye tomorrow early morning and wrap up the season.
Yeah, so last Sunday at Shaw 10, the last meet at Shaw 10 for this season, only two favorites won out of 11 races. Turf course, very fast. Fast Most Furious won the last big race. It's not a stake race, but it was a Class 1 handicap for David Hall and Zach Purton. Tony Cruz won race 3 to cut the trainer margin, but then Ricky Yu came back and won race 5. Tony won race 7. Ricky Yu won race 9. And then in the 11th race, Ricky Yu won by a half length. Tony's horse was flying at the finish but couldn't get there. So Ricky Yu has basically clinched the training title. He has 67 wins. Tony has 63. But Tony only has 4 starters in tomorrow. So the best he could do is they all win. Ricky doesn't win any and he ties. Francis Liu got shut out on Sunday, but he has 7 in tomorrow. So it looks like Ricky Yu has clinched the training title. Zach Purton has clinched the riding title with 145 wins. That's his 4th premiership among the jockeys. Joe Moreira was 138. Karastina had a great year with 91 winners. Vincent Ho, a terrific local rider, had 65, and he won quite a few stake races. So we thought the two titles might come down to the last day, but Joe had 2 suspensions in the last 3 meets. He's suspended for tomorrow, and Zach just continued to pile up winners. So those titles are done. Tomorrow morning, now here's the good thing. You can go on HKJC, go to local, go to horse race, and then go to local, then go to current odds, and you can see live prices for tomorrow's card because we're now less than 24 hours from the first race post time. So I went, tomorrow I got 3 plays, kind of a mix. Race 5, I like number 6, Kinda Cool. This is a 3-year-old, improving. Drew Pauly, its first 2 starts, especially the second start, post 14, going 6 furlongs. But it wasn't even fought that day. Last time, Drew better, just kind of raced evenly, didn't have that much punch, but he's back in against good ones. He draws perfectly in post 5. I looked up the odds. He's right now 3-1 second choice. So 3-1, I'd be very happy with number 6, Kinda Cool, in race 5. Race 8, I'm going to go with the 1, Butterfield. Yes, he's the assigned high weight, but he gets 10 pounds off with Jerry Chow. And Jerry Chow had 2 winners on Sunday. So he's developing, and he'll be a force next season. Butterfield draws post 5, going 2 turns. 16:50. They start pretty much near the finish line and go around once. So hopefully we can work out a trip. Last time out, he showed good speed. So if he does that again, I think we could hang around, especially with the weight off. And then the last race of the day, what better way to end the Hong Kong racing season with a long shot from Matthew Poon.
Not a boy.
He rides number 12, Racing Fighter. He's 18-1 as we speak. And he had a big race 2 back, and that was at Shaw 10. He ran in Happy Valley last time. The line doesn't look that good, but then you examine it a little closer, he made up some ground in a blanket finish. And I think with a decent trip from post 5, this has gone 6 furlongs, I think we can stalk, not be too far back, and hopefully get up in time. Because when you see Poon win, he usually is flying at the end, so... We'll see if Matthew Poon can send us off on a high note for the 2019-2020 Hong Kong racing season.
Love it. Our man, Matthew Poon. Quite a bit of coverage, too, at DRF. Marcus, talking about the end of the season as well, and John Moore. And, what will be interesting, Dick, is when we reconvene, late summer, and, there'll be some... some shifts and changes, and there's always a few new people that get admitted, and that process is interesting to watch. But as usual, entertaining season, and particularly when there was a dearth of of racing action. And, you know, certainly if there's one person who can be singled out for, you know, for taking an interest in Hong Kong, it's Tommy Masses. who's $1 million richer thanks to taking an interest while racing was nearly suspended completely in North America.
You know, now we lose John Moore to the mandatory retirement age, and John's not retiring from training. He's just not going to train in Hong Kong. He'll be in Australia. I think he's going to be training with his family, and I'm sure he's just going to do great. But the trainer that's kind of replacing him is David Hayes. And David Hayes is a very successful trainer in Australia. And I was looking the other day, they sent out a bunch of import information, new horses coming in. And quite a few of them were already with David Hayes. So I'm sure he will hit the ground running, good, solid stable, and he knows his way around. And so the John Moore saga is over. It's just a sensational trainer, probably one of the all-time greats over there. And we'll see if David Hayes can, you know, kind of take the baton and keep going with it. But, the local guys are tough. You know, Ricky Yu, Francis Liu, they're just super. So it just gives you a great mix. And it's you know, we don't have... I remember Paul Matisse saying he didn't like tracks where two jockeys win all the races. And, like, there's truth in that. But at the same time, we don't have two trainers winning all the races. We have a lot of trainers with the wins spread out among the, basically, 20, 22 trainers that have licenses.
No, it takes a little bit of study and some commitment, but terrific quality of racing, consistent, and, you know, one of the hallmarks, you know, is the regularity with which you get to, you know, to see these runners, and, you know, that I keep citing that, Dick, talking about the, you know, the Midwestern horses that went from Fawner to Canterbury, and it just so, you know, it for those of us that look at what we consider the A tracks, I mean, the allowance and stake runners, you know, they, you know, they're spreading out 6-7 weeks between starts, and you know, one of the real ways to, you know, be successful as a player is, you know, familiarity with, you know, with horses, and you know, getting a real finger on the pulse, and by having, you know, horses that run regularly and are moving, you know, as you've explained, you know, up and down the weight scale, it's a way to, you know, to plug into successful, you know, identification and handicapping, and the understanding is that, you know, it's easier to get into practice, have it in practice, by being able to see the horses so regularly. And that's one of the things about this that I think people have latched on to.
Yes, and I know the North American simulcast handle, even going into tomorrow, is way ahead of last year.
Nice.
So
nice.
That commingling into the pools is going very well, and I think it will continue to go well and grow from there. And it's like, as Tommy found out and other people have found out, if you put the work in, if you kind of can flatten the learning curve, the rewards are there. Because, you know, you're looking at almost 13 starters per race. You're looking at about $18 average winner, but yet you're still having about 30% winning favorites. So the races have form. You know, they're not just all chaotic races. There is form to them, and when you take 30% and work it into almost 13 starters per race, that's unusually high. So then you're picking your spots. This, you know, these horses look good, these stables look good, and then you're trying to handicap which races are the ones that produce the chaos. And I'll have all I have to do is one more race, one more day tomorrow, and I got my spreadsheet all updated, and I'll be generating all sorts of stuff, analyzing the five class levels, who wins in those class levels, how formful is each class level, and things like that. So we'll have that all updated for next year's season.
Cool. Well, Dick, beyond Hong Kong, and thanks for all the insights this season, quick look ahead to Saratoga opening.
I did some work. I have picks for the Peter Pan on twinspires.com/blog. I like Mott Source Modernist. I liked his win at Aqueduct on a dull track. Then he won at Fairgrounds. Then he drew post 14 at Fairgrounds in the Louisiana Derby, which he had no shot. Off for about 3 months, came back into Belmont, didn't run well, but he has the right running style. I'm going to be real curious, as everyone will be. The main track has been completely redone. They put down some kind of stone base, and I want to see how that's going to play. I think it's going to play pretty fast, and that'll be interesting. Mile and eighth races are historically won by horses that are up on or near the lead. It's not a come from behind distance. So in the Peter Pan, there's three or four that might want the lead, and it's also going to be interesting, Steve, with what Matt was saying, and I think Pat McKenna referenced. There's not going to be a lot of jockey movement, so you're going to pretty much see the Saratoga riding colony at Saratoga day in and day out. And I don't know how much horse movement there's going to be. Shipping in, you can ship the horse, you can't ship help, you know, things like that. So as a handicapper, that's fine with me, because if I just have to handicap the horses that are regular race, you know, regular participants on the NIRA circuit, that theoretically makes it a little bit easier than deal with the normal Saratoga with horses shipping in from all over the East Coast. I mean, that might not turn out to be the case. Stake races, definitely not. They'll be shipping from everywhere. But the day-to-day bread-and-butter races are going to be really interesting. So I've been doing a lot of work. Going over to Belmont Mead, doing a lot of preliminary stuff.
Excellent. Excellent. All right. Well, we're going to...
Coming in ready. No excuses. We'll see you. We'll see by Labor Day.
Exactly. Exactly. No, I'm going to... There'll be regular visits, and we'll get, you know, plays of the day and touch on, you know, touch on spots with virtually... We'll get you back on your regular Thursday, or we'll maybe play around a little bit with the schedule. But we'll get some Dick's picks on a regular basis. All right.
Sounds good.
Dick Powell, everybody. Dick, thanks so much, and thanks to Hong Kong Jockey Club for another fun season. And everybody gets a little freshening, and I'll be back in a couple of months.
Okay. Thanks for having me, Steve.
Not at all. Dick Powell, everybody, and we're going to try to bring some new wrinkles, in fact, for the Hong Kong season. And there's potential maybe for Hong Kong to get plugged into the contest arena. They're discussing that as well, and well worth, you know, latching on. We're going to stay right here, and plenty more to come. Hour three, Jeff Maddie going to join us from Canterbury. We'll look ahead to tomorrow's stakes card, Rusty Arnold as well. And this visit I'm looking forward to, because John Innes yesterday had a terrific score, exactly the kind of sale that he has in mind with what he, you know, with what he does. And it's, you know, buying yearlings that he identifies as having, you know, prospect as a two-year-old, and then training them, getting them on the racetrack, which of course was complicated this year, and then selling them through, in this case, the horse of racing age sale that just completed last night. John Enos joins us. John, congratulations.
Thanks very much. Thanks very much. It's been a whirlwind 24 hours, and I still can't believe it.
How long have you been doing this concept? You know, picking out the yearling and then, you know, getting them going, and as opposed to just putting them in a 2-year-old in training sale?
I've been doing it for the last 2 or 3, 4 years maybe. You know, I'll go to Keene in September, Paisley Tipton in October, and basically try and buy inexpensive yearlings that physically look the part, and obviously they might have an issue or two with them. Obviously I won't take something that's going to be a massive problem or something, but no, I'm just trying to buy physicals, and the last 3 or 4 years I've been getting a little bit lucky with it, and I think it's a great concept to do, because you decide when you run them, and you decide when they're ready, unlike a 2-year-old sale where you have to be ready on that day, and you have to go fast on that day, and if you don't, you might not sell the horse. So a lot goes into that day. Where what I do at the race it's you decide when you run them, and you decide when they're ready to go. So yeah, no, it's, thank God, it's worked out great so far.
And when you think about it, I mean, not to, you know, not that it's going to be a wholesale change to the landscape of the 2-year-old in training sale concept, but it does make a lot of sense. I mean, for starters, I always bring up the point, John, that you look at some pedigrees, and you look at the foaling date on some of these, 2-year-olds, and late April, May foal, going to be behind physically, might be a pedigree that isn't a win early type, and the horse goes in 10 and 4, the horse goes in, 23 flat. Who cares? What's the difference? It has nothing to do with what the horse is going to become later down the road.
Yeah, I agree. I agree totally. You know, it's kind of crazy how commercial it's gone with the sales and whatnot. And that's what people want. They want to buy that commercial mare or that commercial stallion potential. And if you get a horse that's a race horse, and County Final is a race horse, and people will buy a race horse if he's proven he can run. They will buy a race horse. So, I've never done the pinhook and the 2-year-old sale job, so I can't really comment too much on it. But I like what I'm doing, and I think it works.
Talk a little bit, and we'll get into specifics about about this this Oxbow as an example in a second. But talk a little bit about your background. Irish by birth. Talk about how you got onto the racetrack or just into the game from early on.
Yeah, basically, since I was 15 or 16 back home in Ireland, I wanted to be a jockey. I was very small and light, and I rode for many years back home on the flat and steeplechase. Maybe 10 years ago or so, I decided to come over here, and I was basically just galloping over here and just seeing how I liked Lexington, Kentucky, and broke a lot of babies and done all that stuff with as much work as I could get, basically, and I've always done horses, and maybe six years ago probably, I kind of got involved with one horse that I'd done myself, and it kind of just snowballed where I am now, and I've learned so much over here, and I've learned so much about, looking at yearlings and looking at babies, and back home we've always broke 2-year-olds, and we've always broke yearlings, so that part was no problem, and I've always liked working with the yearlings and 2-year-olds, so it all kind of just snowballed into this, and this is what I like doing. I like buying the yearlings, and I like breaking them myself, and doing this and getting them forward to the racetrack.
Did you bankroll this yourself? Do you have some partners that work at it with you?
No, I don't have anybody with me. I do it all. I buy all the yearlings on my own. I buy all the yearlings. I go to I say Faisic October and Keene in September, always on my own. I put up my own money, which isn't a lot to most people, but I put up my own money, and then I try and sell, you know, 25% share or 33% share or 50% share to horses that I like. And, you know, they'll help me with their share being sold to them. That'll help me carry it through with the day rate and whatnot to the races in the spring. And but I'm trying to buy a horse that I want to train, that I think can run and physically looks like it can run. So, and then I'll put it towards my clients that I have already in the barn. As a, I've just bought a yearling that I really like, and hence with this Oxbow on them, I'd advise you to get involved, because I think he's a racehorse. And I have a couple of others like that that are in the barn now that have not started yet, but they're the same deal. I kind of like them too, and I bought them all myself. And I'm just grateful to the clients that got involved with me, Hayden Noriega and Diego Conde. They were good enough to get involved with an Oxbow and trust me in what I did, and it's all paid off, thank God.
Unbelievable. And it's just, you know, to me, it's a great story. And, you know, I've seen your name certainly in the PPs, but to, you know, to know the backstory on it, you know, guys like John Hancock, you know, I think, you know, well known and have a similar approach, you know, but to have a score like this and you know, sell one for $475, very, very cool. You know, what did you go into the sale expecting?
He was very popular. I consigned him myself as well, actually yesterday. So he was very well received. There wasn't many people at Fasig, to be honest, because it was just a horse and training sale, but there was a lot of agents there, and all the right agents and all the right people were on the horse. He was very, very well received. He showed himself fantastically. The standing to the horse, he looked great, walked fantastic, clean x-rays and clean scope. And we didn't know what to expect, but with the right people on him, we said he could sell for anything. And Fasig were pretty confident that he's going to sell well. And it was my first time consigning, so all the buyers and potential buyers were asking me what's the reserve, or I said, or what's he going to make? And I said, I'm not lying to you. I actually don't know, because it's my first time doing it. I don't know what he can bring or what he's going to do. And I said, I hope he sells, because this is what I do. But if he doesn't sell, I'm happy to take the horse home. I think he is a legitimate horse, and I think he's going to have a big future this summer. So I'm happy to take the horse home. The other partners don't want to give him away, and they're happy to keep going forward, and I'm happy to go forward with him too. But look, we'll see what happens. And I said, I don't know reserve. He said, oh, you do know reserve. I said, I don't know what he's going to sell, so I can't tell you. It's my first time doing this. And but it was just, look, it was fantastic. I was speechless after. I didn't, you know, it was amazing.
I love it. The $475,000, and we should include in excuse me, in the story that, you know, he won at First Asking, of course, and that was good, you know, right out of the gate. Wins the debut. That was on June 5th at Churchill, and you know, that was $45,000, you know, off of the debut, and then he's second in the Bashford Manor. So, you know, people are buying and they're looking at a graded stake placed you know, colt right off the bat. Go back to that maiden win. He was 9-1, and you know, how confident were you that he could win first out?
Well, you're never confident that they can win first time, especially juveniles. He was very well schooled. He was well pressed. All mine typically need a race, so if they do go and win first time, you know, there's more to come. I never really take him off the bridle at home, but he was breathing really nice. James Graham had come down and sat in him before he ran, and he loved him. I actually had him entered on the dirt, and I got excluded. And I didn't really want to run in the grass because I'd never been honest with him. He worked so good in the dirt. And so the grass actually came up pretty soft that day at Churchill. And I told James, look, just be easy with the horse. Don't knock him about. Educational ride. And I said he's a little slow away from the gates, but he's very quick into his stride. So he should get a good spot for you. And he was he stepped slow out of the gates, but within two strides, his cruising speed just took him to lead. And he didn't see another rival. And It was fantastic that he won in the grass. And The only reason I ran him on the grass, because I was high on the horse and I wanted to run the Bastard Manor, but I wanted to get a race into him. And that was the last real opportunity in the time frame that might work to get to the Bastard Manor. It was 3.5 weeks or so before the Bastard Manor. But I need to get a race in them. As I said, I was in the maiden on the dirt a week previously, but I got excluded. I was on the A's. So, yeah, we just took a shot on the grass and we got in, and I wasn't sure about it. But as I said, if he finished in the first three on the grass, I'd still take a shot in the Bastard Manor, because I think he's a really nice dirt horse. And he won his maiden, and he didn't disgrace by any means in the Bastard Manor either. He ran a super race.
Unbelievable. And run second to that nice Casadero of Steve Asmussen. And actually, Asmussen is involved in this story anyway, John. John Enos is with us, who sold the Oxbow colt yesterday for $475,000 at the Horses of Racing Age sale, and bought him as a baby for small money. And it is a little strange, because that dam, Tapajo, I see. I mean, she was a stakes winner herself, a Tappet of the Winchells. And, he certainly on the page, he must have been attractive. What day did he? How far into the catalog was he at Caitlin?
He was. I'm nearly sure it was like the second day of book four. That's typically when I can start buying horses, because they're come a little bit cheaper. But physically, for me that day, he was a standout. He was just physically a beautiful horse, and Oxbow was kind of putting me off, because I'm trying to get a bit of form on them, like win first time and sell them. So it's very hard to sell an Oxbow that's not commercial. You know, we talked about it earlier. People are wanting to buy these commercial pedigrees. And he really didn't have a commercial pedigree, but I just loved the colt. I just loved him, everything about him. He was so correct. He had a great walk. He was so professional in the back ring. And I just had to have him. And lucky for me, I did get him that day,
Unbelievable. $9,500, and it was offered by Bally Sox Bloodstock back as a yearling. Explain to people, John, how to find a bargain, and what are the things that stop you from buying a horse at a price like this. You mentioned, you're looking for individuals. And, I mean, is that a horse that might be, immature at that point in September? What kinds of things are secrets to finding this kind of horse?
There has to be a physical, but there has to be very mature mentally. They have to take, everything in their stride. Obviously, what I do, I have to have the correct horse too. So I'm putting all these factors in, and these are all like factors for nice horses. So the horses that I can actually buy is very limited, because it's very easy to see the nice horses, and everybody sees the nice horses. So, I typically can't get a commercial stallion or whatnot like that, because if he's correct and he's clean X-rays and he ticks all the boxes, My budget can't buy them. So I have to go through. Persistence is the key as well. You have to be at the sales all the time. You have to be there every day, and persistence, and look at every horse. And it's a lot of work, but persistence. And it's very easy to spot the nice horses. But then, I don't open up a catalogue until I see the physical. And if I open up the catalogue, I love the horse, but I open up the catalogue and it's by Curlin, or it's by Constitution, or it's by, as I say, a commercial horse, I just close the catalogue. Well, I can't touch that, because I won't be able to buy it. And I don't want to buy something, pay too much money for something that I can't make a return on. So it's all, I have a price of them. When I see the horse, I have a top price in my mind that I want to pay for it. And I go up, and if it exceeds that price that I have in my mind, I walk away. And because I think I've lost the value on it then, for me, to make a return. But there's so many little factors that you have to wager in to buy in. But mentally, they have to be sound, and they have to look like a racehorse physically too. And I'm not buying something that kind of going to be running in the fall or running as a three-year-old. I want to be buying something that's going to be ready for Keenan Spring, Churchill Springtime, them type of horses.
Well, and, you know, it's a balance, obviously, and, you know, being able to, you know, to hit one out of the park like this. When he won, and then when he was second in the Bashford, you must have also had private, you must have had phone calls for a private purchase too, no?
Yeah, we had some people call, but, you know, they were kind of, I thought, like, a little bit lowballing us, offering. I thought the horses were more than what they were offering. And the client, or my partners, didn't really want to let him go for nothing. They said they'd rather race him. And I just felt the reason, it's not the lowballing because it's me or because he's Oxford. It's just because they didn't see his physical. So I thought the horse racing age sale at Fayton Tiffin was ideal. When they get to see this horse physically, then they'll realize, like, wow, look at this horse. This, oh, yeah, I know what you're talking about now. This is actually a nice colt. Like, when everybody that came and seen him yesterday, there wasn't one person who did not like the horse. They were like, he's a proper horse. And they were just, like, kind of wowed by him. So he looks the part. He shows he can run. So hence why I didn't really want to tell him privately. I said I'd made my mind up that the horse of racing age was the place to go.
Well, and, you know, we should mention, I mean, there's probably people saying, you know, has he had success with others? And there was one that you had going back to last year that I can think of as well, which was Biddy Duke, the Bayern filly that Doug O'Neill's got, right? That was you.
I own half of her as well. She's a same sort of small filly. Very small filly, actually, but I liked her. I mean, I seen her as a yearling. She's very in proportion, very correct. Looked like a 2-year-old. Great mentally, great. And I just said, yeah, that's a 2-year-old filly. And look, she didn't win, but she ran against Salty Company in Keeneland and Churchill and was placed both times to do Wesley Ward's nice fillies. As I said, the thing we do, we take 2-year-olds with farm to July of last year, and she sold her like 40,000 last year, and she's went out to California and she's done fantastically. And I've just seen recently she's been stakes placed in California, so she's proven she can run out there. So she's black type now on her pedigree as well. And the year before that, I bought a Yes It's True yearling at Basic for 7,000, and he won the juvenile at Churchill the year before. So I got him sold as well at the July Basic thing. So, no, the last 2 or 3 years I've been quite lucky with my horses that the yearlings have been buying for very little money.
Well, and John, we should also mention, I mean, that you train throughout the year, and so there's horses that, you know, you go on with, and you're it's not like, you know, you're only busy through the spring.
For sure. I've got plenty of clients in the barn there that are very loyal to me and they've stuck with me, and I'm very grateful to them. And it's not just the 2-year-olds. It's the yearlings and 2-year-olds is what I do for myself. It's my own kind of business that I started up, and I introduced my clients to the yearlings / 2-year-olds that I want to train and try and get them involved that way to trust me into buying yearlings for them. And no, it's worked so far, and they're all kind of wanting to get on board with, you know, the cheaper yearlings and having a shop for small stakes and a small percentage of them, and it's working out.
I love it. Just delighted for the success. One more question about a young horse and projecting them, as they mature. What, you know, where are you looking when you're watching the walk, looking at confirmation and so forth? How do you project how a horse is going to grow?
I don't think it's that anything you can explain to anyone, really. I just look at them and I can see, like, okay, that's you see straight away that's two turn. That's definitely not a 2 year old, and that's going to grow. That's you can't explain it. You can't explain it, but it's you just. I don't know if I know or if I'm just getting lucky. I don't know what it is, but. I don't know what it is. I can't get it, to be honest. Maybe I'm just getting lucky.
No. It is remarkable, and it's one of the things that really differentiates, you know, horsemen, and it's how, you know, it's how bloodstock people, you know, that buy for clients. It's how they make it work. I mean, you're adding an extra layer of knowledge and experience by training them into the beginnings of their career. But, you know, there's people that are looking at these yearlings, and when they look at them, they're able in their mind's eye to picture the horse as a 2 year old, and then even as a 3 year old. And that's the difference. I mean, that's the magic.
Yes, I agree totally. It's the whole industry, especially at the sales, at the races, it's all built on opinions, and everybody has their own opinion, and that's what makes the game so fantastic. Everybody has a different opinion on a different horse, and what I think looks like a race horse as a 2 year old, the guy beside me might think I'm completely crazy, and that's he's not right or wrong, vice versa. I'm not right or I'm not wrong. It's our opinion, and his will work today, and mine won't, and mine will work tomorrow, and his won't. And that's how it goes, and it's just a fantastic game that we play, and it keeps us going back.
Well, for those that want to get to know John more, you can follow him on Twitter, John Enos with 2 N's, 35. That's you, yes?
Yep.
And you can follow his progress. You can talk about helping him and maybe bankrolling him. I'm sure he'd be happy to hear from you. And John, who are some of your mates and pals that are in the business? That came over before you did, or that you're close to around the game.
I know everybody around the Lexington area, all the trainers here, and even last night, everybody that was at all the other consigners and the farms and all the Irish people here in Lexington, they're all so supportive, so happy for me. It's fantastic. It's kind of very family orientated, the horse industry, especially here in Lexington. It's fantastic. It's just fantastic here. My best friend, who's been my best friend for 20 odd years, he's obviously another successful trainer up in Maryland, up in Laurel. His name is Jerry O'Dwyer. He's doing fantastic up there too. And me and him, we work together a lot with bouncing off ideas to each other. You know, he'll send horses down here to run in Kentucky, and I'll send a couple up to Laurel to run. So he's up there and I'm down here. So we try and work it out between us, and it's fantastic. He's a great, great friend of mine, and he's always there to end the phone if I need advice or anything to talk with.
Oh, that's great. And Jerry's been on with us many times, and I'm glad I asked. Well, so delighted to get you on. John Enos, everybody. County final yesterday, $475,000. And Randy Hill, who, of course, we talked to last week, the Speedle family and West Point all grouped in together to buy this one. George Weaver is going to handle him going forward. So good hands on that front too. John, continued success. Well done, and you know, happy shopping at Fasig and Keeneland this September.
Thank you so much, and thanks very much for having me on. It's been great.
Not at all. John Enos, everybody, with a terrific, the kind of success that you know, when you're doing what he's doing, this is what, you know, this is the kind of night that you're hoping for. And you can tell he's got a great feel, and he's got a nice formula. And now you know when you see his name in the program. And he's got one running. In fact, I should have asked him. He's got one running at Belterra tomorrow. Now you know when you see the name who it is, John Enos. A little past the top of the hour. We're into hour three. We've got Jeff Maddy coming and Rusty Arnold yet this morning. Stay with us. And I want to let you know that tomorrow, I want to get out ahead of it. Looking forward to, well, Andy's going to be on, Serling. We'll do our Saratoga preview with Andy. But we're going to talk to Bob Hutton, who's the head of the Arizona HBPA. And Bob is going to bring everybody up to date on the just intolerable situation in Arizona when it comes to the signal. Players in Arizona, and you know, you see them just bemoaning the fact, rightly, that they're being denied an opportunity to play a lot of popular signals, including already now, you know, a couple of weeks in, Monmouth and Del Mar are not available yet. It's amazing that this has not gotten more discussion and attention. I mean, things in Arizona are a mess, period. But when it comes to the racing and to this, to the signal battle, it's inexcusable. So Bob Hutton tomorrow to talk about that, as well as Sid Fernando, Sire Watch Pedigree Focus, brought to you by Hill and Dale. Right now, though, let's take a break. Come back. We'll run through till noon with Jeff at Canterbury and Rusty Arnold as well. We'll talk to Rusty about his summer plans and how many, and if he's, I don't think he's sending, I think he's going to stay in Kentucky and then probably just, you know, send a few into Saratoga. But, you know, usually, so look forward to Rusty being here. Let's take a timeout. Hour three at the races. Back after this, SiriusXM.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on SiriusXM Radio.
Our Pennsylvania breeding program was, of course, impacted by the pandemic. Now, with our country getting back to work, we'd like to again talk about our program, the best in North America. Our breeder awards will remain up to 50% for PA-sired PA breds. Owner bonuses will also stay at up to 40%. Restricted races will again be run at all three PA tracks, and PA Day at the races will return. I'm Brian Sanfratello. For more, please visit PABred.com.
Developed by Horstman, HorseBills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving, environment-friendly, paperless revolution of how equine industries bill and receive payments. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for each horse, whose owners can pay through the same website with just one click. Say goodbye to stacks of invoices, handwritten checks, and postage costs. Easy accounting for all parties with the highest online security measures. Get started free at HorseBills.com. Simply register with your name and email address. Free to sign up. No subscription fees to vendors until the first invoice. Voices sent. For owners, you get a free account, comprehensive dashboard with information on all horses owned and billing records, ACH and credit card payment options. For vendors, generate invoices efficiently and receive payments quickly from both owners and other vendors. Syndicate and partnership managers get flexible billing and payment options to both vendors and syndicate members. For more info, call 888-938-4643, 888-938-4643, or log on to horsebills.com. That's horsebills.com.
Get started in Kentucky. Over $8 million in additional purse money is available at the five Kentucky tracks for horses eligible for the Kentucky Thoroughbred Development Fund. Kentucky is a good place to race your Kentucky bred. Come home to Kentucky and make a start.
DRF Sports Form Digital Edition, your ultimate weekly betting guide. Published by Daily Racing Form, DRF Sports Form delivers all of the analysis and insight you need for every NFL game and more than 40 college football matchups. Beat the spread with powerful trends and sharp angles. Tap into best bets, expert picks, parlay winners, and more. All for just $4.99 per issue. Get this week's edition free. Visit drf.com/sportsform. Enter code DRFSports.
Of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program can prepare you for an exciting career in racing. Turn your passion into a paycheck. Nearly 90% of our students are employed in the racing industry immediately upon graduation. What career track are you on? The University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program. Enroll today and get on track for success. For scholarship opportunities and more, check out our website at ua-rtip.org.
Why is accreditation important in aftercare? Thoroughbred Aftercare Alliance's standard of accreditation and grant process provide donors with confidence that their contributions are allocated in the most effective manner. GAA accreditation is only awarded after a complete review of an organization. Aftercare cannot be an afterthought for the industry. To learn more or support the TAA's mission, visit thoroughbredaftercare.org. Serious.